This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 352 for Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me this week, again, is Miss Megan Townsend. You can find her at Oh Megan Townsend on all the social media that matters, including her Twitch channel, where she is streaming Minecraft and other fun things. Megan, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. It's midweek. It's the midweek hump. I've been very busy, but I've been productive, and I like getting a lot done between Monday and Wednesday. It means that if I decide to take it easier on Friday, that I feel less guilty. Is essentially
right.
How that rolls. So
right.
And Monday to Wednesday is my podcasting window of the week, and I find that those days are very heavily scheduled, and so there's less time to mess around. Like once, you know, I record the Spawn Chunks on Monday at 10 a.m. Then there's usually a gym break around lunchtime, and then I have to publish the show, and then it's dinner time. Like, so like the whole day is just done. And then Tuesday is a lot of admin and email and banking stuff. And it's the first of the month. So we've got all that kind of stuff going on. And Wednesday is usually, you know, Citadel Cafe with you. So then, you know, once we get into Thursday, Friday, my weeks tend to be more flexible, at which point I can either stay the course and stay on track or lose track. And yeah. I lost track last week. So I've been kind of like catching up this week. And yeah, so that's kind of where I am. How's your week going? We always ask like, how are you? But like, how specifically has your week been going?
It's been good. It's been pretty busy this week. It's been pretty busy this week. I've been going to the gym a lot more often this week. And
so you're touting the bulging biceps of Doom.
Yeah. Like no
future superhero.
I mean, ideally, but I don't know if I'll ever get the bulging biceps, but you know, we'll see.
And some people don't want them. Some people don't want them. Like some people don't want like Arnold Schwarzenegger arms, you know?
No. And I don't, but I would definitely like to get strong. That's kind of what one of my ambitions are, is just to get nice and strong.
Nice.
For sure. But I've been working a bunch. It's more so the end of this week that is really busy for me. I'm getting new headshots taken on Friday, and that's all the way in Dartmouth. So that's a bit of a jaunt. And I have an audition on Sunday. And as far as I understand, I am volunteering for a filmmakers conference here in the city called the New Waves Conference. So there's it's called Women Making Waves. So there's a film group in Nova Scotia and Halifax called Women in Film and Television. And it's specifically like a union for women who are working in film and television. So they have a conference every year that, you know, women who are looking to learn more information, they can go to this conference. The tickets are expensive, so I'm going to volunteer so I can get some time to meet people and talk to people instead, so I can get in for free. Yeah.
And it sounds like a really cool convention too.
Yeah. It's only like 2 days, which is nice. And, I still, you know, need to confirm exactly which days I'm, you know, what times I'm going to be there at. They did send me a schedule, and I've not, you know, I haven't really gone through and like found out exactly like what I can accept and what not yet. So I'm probably gonna do that after we're done, honestly. So this weekend is kind of shaping up to be pretty busy.
Nice. Out of curiosity, what time on Friday are you in the dark side?
I will be there. So my headshot session is at 1. I plan on leaving my house at around 11 o'clock.
Okay.
because it takes me about an hour.
Oh yeah, easily. No, I've done that commute before. No, the reason I'm asking is my Friday is, as I mentioned, flexible. And so after said headshots, maybe because you're in my hood, we could hang out. That would be fun.
Yeah, let's do that.
We get to hang out on podcast once a week, but not very often do we get to actually poke people in the arm and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of being busy and being busy on weekends, this past weekend was the town hall hangout. And if you're like, I don't know what that is, let me explain. there's a new post on Patreon. It's labeled as a barista cut with Alistair because I just didn't really have a good way to communicate this because it's going to likely be a future goal that we include on the Sizzle Cafe Patreon, where we do a quarterly hangout with our patrons, discussing how the podcast is doing, how we're growing, what our goals are for the future. So the Barista Cut is really this town hall hangout that I experimented with this weekend. It was recorded live with a chat room of patrons of the Sizzle Cafe, but also my personal Patreon and my Twitch subscribers, which all lead to the same Discord. So it was great because there's more people, because there's only about 20 patrons of the Sizzle Cafe, but between Twitch subs, my own personal Patreon page, and the Sizzle Cafe, there was probably 14 or 15 people in the chat easily. And that amasses to like almost 100 people in Discord, I think. So, and it just depends on like when people were available, etc. But we recorded it so that if you missed it, you can go back and listen to the live interaction. And there's a lot of talk about the Sizzle Cafe at the start, because the bulk of the town hall hangout actually focuses on things like the Twitch channel, YouTube channels, future channel development, plans for streams in the future, that sort of thing. But there is a lot of podcast talk as well as milestones, goals, downloads, you know, how far we've grown in the last year, that sort of thing. So this was kind of like an experiment of like, I'd like to do this more often, but I want to put it behind some sort of Patreon goal where it actually makes sense to devote the time to take, you know, a Saturday afternoon once a quarter to sit down with just the Citadel Cafe patrons. Because essentially what I would do in the future is I would spin this out. It would not be a barista cut. It would be its own town hall thing. And I would not combine the Twitch chat Minecraft stuff with the Citadel Cafe stuff. It would more than likely be two separate hangouts, because one would deal with more of a live audience and the other would deal with an audience that would mostly listen to the Citadel Cafe on a download basis. Like, you know, podcasts are great because you can download them, listen to them at your convenience. However, one of the goals that was suggested for the Citadel Cafe would be to record it live. I have no plans to do that on Twitch. I don't want to be on video. I don't plan on doing that kind of a thing. But we can record and broadcast live to the Discord. So the Citadel Cafe would still be recorded on Wednesday whenever the two, you know, co-hosts are available to do that. But we would let people know in the Discord, hey, we're recording this Wednesday at, say, like 11 a.m. If you're around, listen to this audio channel and you can hear maybe Megan and I, or, you know, myself and Alistair or whoever's on the show, talk and produce the show live. We won't necessarily be able to interact with the chat room during the show, but before and after we could have like a short little like interactions and stuff like that. And I think that could be kind of fun as kind of a goal. So, so there are links to that in the Discord. I'll have a link to the town hall hangout, on the website. It's only going to be available to patrons, so it won't matter for the public, but I do want to have the link easily accessible for people, because not everyone that supports me or the podcast is in the Discord, because some people are just not Discord people. So I want to make sure that Patreon hangout link is out there. If you are part of the Citadel Cafe Patreon and you are using the patron-only RSS feed, the hangout should have shown up in your downloads already. It's probably already in your podcast player, so just look for it there. It's called 351 Barista Cut with Alistair. It's about 90 minutes long. A little bit more housekeeping. In addition to that, we didn't release this publicly because we weren't sure how to approach it. We thought it best to approach it with our patrons first. But Johnny and I on the Spawn Chunks record what's called the Render Distance. It's an extended version of the podcast for just the patrons. Spawn Chunks is roughly an hour and 15. We record an extra half an hour, usually 20 minutes before and about 10 minutes after the show. And make that longer recording that sandwiches the Spawn Chunks available on our Patreon for patrons. During the Render Distance for episode 78, we had to address some, we'll call it housekeeping, I guess, in terms of enthusiastic fan etiquette. I clipped out the relevant piece, so it's not the whole Render Distance, it's just the 8-minute conversation where Johnny and I talked about this, and I posted it in my Patreon, there's a link in my personal Patreon and there's a link in the Discord to it on Google Drive. This isn't a public thing. This is a Patreon Spawnchunks thing. So if you are part of a different Patreon and you are getting access to this, all I ask is that you don't share it with anybody. It's not a big deal if you happen to do it, but I would prefer that you didn't, because we're trying to just address the most enthusiastic fans, which are more than likely patrons of any said media. So really the relevant piece that I clipped out is a part where we talked about this in a reasonable way, the difference between referrals and recommendations and advertising and spam when it comes to sharing creator content. Essentially just the etiquette behind poking a friend in the arm, which is a phrase I've kind of adopted for this show, to which I mean a friend, someone you know, a coworker, a family member. Poking a friend in the arm is not broadcasting it on Twitter. And sharing on Twitter is fantastic when it's your Twitter feed. But for the Siddle Cafe, for example, I wouldn't at all want people to go into someone's Twitch stream that is not part of our community and just randomly link the Siddle Cafe. That would reflect poorly on you. It would reflect poorly on the podcast. And it's smacks of advertising. And most mods in a Twitch stream are going to smack you for it anyway. They're going to be like, nope, you don't get to do that. And it's not polite. However, on the flip side, like on my Twitch stream, very often the Spawnchunks will come up or the Siddle Cafe will come up, but they're my they're my podcasts. I'm there to promote all the things that I do, and it makes sense that they come up. So context is key. But it's an 8-minute conversation on Discord. Like I said, it's not public, so I won't be able to link it in the Citadel Cafe show notes, but it is there for patrons of this podcast. It's patrons of myself, and all obviously Twitch supporters as well. Everybody that's got access to the Discord has a chance to click on it and listen. I would really encourage you to take the 8 minutes. I would appreciate it. If you have any questions at all, and that includes questions about the Town Hall Hangout, if you weren't there and you had a question about money, where it goes, how it's, you know, what it's going towards, if you have questions about what the shows are going to be in the future, you didn't understand an answer to a question that I made, anything at all you have, either DM me on Discord or send me an email. It's joeleduggan@gmail.com. Really all roads lead to Rome. Like basically it doesn't matter where you post an email to me, it's probably going to get to my main email. But if you want just a direct line, it's very easy. I don't have it usually linked on websites because I get a lot of spam, so I'm just happy to spell it out for you, and you can email me that way. I'd be happy to answer some questions. So yeah, that's all the housekeeping that I have this week. We should probably move on, unless you have anything to add about the Town Hall, because I don't think you were able to make it.
No, I wasn't. Not really.
Cool.
Not off the top of my head, anyway.
Cool. Well, I mean, this goes for you too. I mean that for all the co-hosts, because I know that Brockett and Lou sometimes listen to the show when they're not on it. If you or any of the other co-hosts on the show have input and ideas for how to make it better, by all means, you know, toss them my way, because I'm looking for 2020 to be a growth year for the Citadel Cafe.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Speaking of Brockett, actually, we have another email from Brockett. Yes, still that Brockett. ranking your favorite villain actors. Hi again. Sorry, back for more emails, but I love rankings and lists. So I'd like to hear y'all rank classic bad guy actors playing villains from your favorite to least favorite. So number one would be your favorite villain actor. Sorry for leaving off several like Alan Rickman, and I'll just leave Tim Curry and Christopher Lee out of mine because that's just unfair. Brockett's lists is Dennis Hopper, Christopher Waltz, Malcolm McDowell, Jennifer Bardem, Javier Bardem, I always mispronounce his name, John Malkovich, and Glenn Close. There's plenty more, but a few just jumped to mind, at least three bad roles. Cheers, Brockett. So first off, that's six, Brockett. And
you cheated again.
Yeah. And I misread the order. So I guess Glenn. So one, Dennis Hopper is his favorite villain, I guess, is the way that he wanted to rank them. So number one would be your favorite villain actor. Yeah. So Dennis Hopper being Brockett's number one. So I actually went backwards. I went 5-4-3-2-1 because I thought that was a more interesting conversation. But yes, Brockett cheated. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
You go first.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know if these are my favorite villains, But I would put them up there with actors who were so good at playing the villain that my skin was crawling during the performance. So I, much like Brockett, I'm a Boy Scout, so I like the Boy Scout characters. I very much identify and favorite heroes. I don't like villains. I react the way that the audience should react. I despise them. I want them to be defeated. However, Javier Bardem, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, in No Country for Old Men as Anton Chigurh and Skyfall as Silva was creepy. Mm-hmm. I've not seen him in much. I've only seen those films once. I can't get into the nuances of the performance. I just remember having an irky feeling watching them and just being like, whoa, like, nope, glad that this guy doesn't exist. I think a lot of it has to do with his method of being very calm as a villain. He doesn't say much. And for someone that can, and I've seen many pictures of him, for someone that can be very, I say he's a handsome dude. Like, he can look pretty put together when he's got scruff. There's something about his clean shaven face when shot from like low camera angles. He looks menacing and disturbing. And I don't know how he can go from being so off-putting to being so, like, you see him on a red carpet, he looks very charismatic and approachable. And I just chalk it up to being very subtle with whatever he's doing with his face and acting. And I find him just creepy as all hell. So that's number five. Number four would be Kevin Spacey, specifically from House of Cards as Frank Underwood. I know he's had a longer career, but that is the most recent exposure, and a lot of exposure since it's a series and not just one film. The character of Frank Underwood is intelligent, manipulative, with zero regard for anyone else, including his wife. Scary because of how close the show feels to what could be reality. Like, there's a lot of parallels between that show and real life current politics. And in addition, it's kind of hard to erase Spacey's recent fall from grace, which also makes Underwood even more despicable. So just Kevin, I find Kevin Spacey makes me irky, but then Frank Underwood is just like a whole other level of like, wow, I really don't
extra
like
irky.
Yeah, it's weird though, because despite being disappointed in some of the things that have come to light as Kevin Spacey as a person, I find that in House of Cards, even though I don't like Frank Underwood, he's an incredibly interesting villain to watch. Like, he's charismatic, and you don't necessarily like him, but you kind of wish without the moral flux. Like, you don't want to cross over to murder and being an evil person, but the kind of way that he flexes his power is very alluring, right? Like, you have that kind of like, I wish I could be that kind of a dick and get away with it. You know, like, I wish I could talk to people like that. I never do, but boy, do I do it in my head. You know? And actually, quite in that show, often Frank Underwood will look at the camera and break the fourth wall and say the things he's really thinking but can't say in a political venue, and you're like, whoa, wow. that was harsh. The next one is an interesting performance. Vincent D'Onofrio in Daredevil as Wilson Fisk / Kingpin. It's a slow burn. It's not something that grabs you from the beginning. He has an odd sense of calm and being misunderstood. And there's a love story for Fisk in the series as well, which gives you a softer side to the villain. He's definitely human, but then his upbringing and that calm combined with unpredictable, extraordinary violence is just so unnerving. And so you get to see it once or twice. And then once you know that it happens, then the entire rest of the time he's on screen, you're waiting for the pop. Like, you're waiting for the kettle to boil over. And it's that tension that I think really sells D'Onofrio as Wilson Fisk and Kingpin. Plus, he's just a big dude. He has a real presence. I've seen him in interviews, and he's so different in interviews compared to how he plays Fisk. I thought it was really, really well done. My second is Tobias Menzies from Outlander. Not my favorite show. I kind of fell off, but boy.
God, he was fucking heinous in that.
There's no way, there's no other way to say it. He's a villain that takes pleasure in breaking down his enemies mentally and emotionally, not just killing them. He is intimately violent.
Like, it's I was like, I almost stopped watching because of him.
Yeah, I did. I did for a number of other reasons. I felt that the story between Claire and I can't remember her husband's name.
Oh, Frank.
No, Frank is the one that's played by Tobias Menzies. I mean, her husband in Scotland.
Oh, Jamie.
Yeah. So Jamie and Claire, I found that their emotional back and forth tended to go in circles. And I was just like, okay, I don't want to watch a Friends sitcom set in 1800s or 1600s or whatever it was. So so to me, that was meh. Because they moved to Italy, I think, or France. And then it was just the exact same storyline over again, just with a different backdrop. And I was like, okay, well, I'm done. Because I didn't find it was very interesting. But I think it was only the first season, maybe the second season I got through. But when Jamie is imprisoned by Jack Randall, who is Tobias Menzies' character, I mean, it is like... brutal. And I mean, and I have like a weird kind of like irky thing with anything with hands, because I'm an artist. Like anything where people are like breaking fingers or breaking hands with like hammers, like I'm
I can't, I'm out, that
hits real close to home. And so, but there's a lot more to it. I won't get into it because it's also worth experiencing for the first time.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, like it just, it's one of those things, like if you know it's coming, then it's not as terrifying, you know, like there's just a lot to that character. And it's not all just like, you know, actual physical violence. There's just a certain way that he talks to people, the way that he talks to Claire. There's a scene early on when she's at like his dinner table and he's eating something and he's just basically menacing her and threatening her subtly, you know, the way that like an English general would threaten people.
Yeah.
But there's this double-edged sword of like, because he's related directly to her husband in the future, he looks just like her husband. He's played by the same actor, so spitting image. So it's really unnerving for her to have this evil person be in her face all the time. But it's also
looks like the man she loves.
He looks like the man she loved and married, you know? And I have to tip my hat also to Menzies, because I didn't find it so sellable in other situations. Like back in the season, as they go on, you eventually get to see more interaction between Claire and Frank Randall, and he's less cozy. He becomes, and I don't know whether it's that the actor has changed his approach or the fact that you've seen him so much as Jack Randall that when he portrays Frank Randall, you just want to throw him off a bus. Like you just want him to get away from it.
I think it's the latter, because I did, so my roommate's been watching it and I kind of just fell off a little bit and then came back to the beginning of season two and like, you know, when she, you know, at spoilers, I guess. It's been going on for a number of years now. So when she comes back to the present time and she reunites with Frank, she's really unnerved by him because she's so used to seeing his face. Like, I don't know how long she's been gone, for years, I guess. So she's so used to seeing his face as someone evil. And, you know, it's, I think as an audience, we haven't seen Frank in so long that when we see Frank, we just see Jack Randall instead. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a simultaneous thing. Like the audience is kind of just like, oh, I saw you being real, real heinous. I know it's not you, but like it's your face and it's uncomfortable.
And you also get his reaction to, like, he's now standoffish and concerned and wondering where the heck his wife has been. Because this is also like circa 1940s, 1950s. I think the Second World War is just over. In the quote unquote future, it's still a period piece. So relationships between men and women back in the 40s and 50s are still very different than they are now. And so there's a lot of tension there. And it's also, you're seeing him being like, well, you know, you're explaining all this stuff to me, but like you were also missing from my life for 6 months or a year, or whatever it was. And now you just kind of show up.
It was like 2 years.
2 years. Like, and then you just kind of show up. Like, how am I not supposed to be mad at you? So like he's mad at his wife for this disappearance, and it can be misconstrued as like being evil, but he's justifiably mad because she left him for 2 years. She didn't want to. No. Yeah. She was time traveled by accident or whatever it happens to be. Like, I don't know. I don't remember how they explain it or if they even do.
It's like there's specific rocks. There's like these specific rocks.
Right.
in a certain time of year that, you know, are, it's Craig na Dune is known for being like a, you know, like the place where the fairies live.
Right.
Like even now, like, you know, Craig na Dune is a real place and people still consider it a very like spiritual, very magical sort of place. It's like, you know, the Scottish and the Irish are very funny because they're just like, don't believe in fairies, but you also don't fuck with the fairies.
Yeah.
It's just a thing, right? It's like, don't believe in them, but don't fuck with them just in case.
Right.
So like Craig na Dune was kind of known for that. Everyone's like, oh, it's super magical and spiritual. Doesn't do anything, but it's just be careful over there because it's magic. Mm. And it's something to do with like precious stones. Because right. I remember distinctly at the beginning, like when Claire is first taken to the past into the 1800s, her watch stops ticking because the quartz in her watch was absorbed by the magic.
I remember
seeing a clip. My grandmother's watch. I've seen little bits and pieces of it. My grandmother read the books and she was watching the show, and she was saying that Claire's whole, like, her eventually, a few later on, she has a daughter, like when Claire comes back to, you know, to be with Frank, like, you know, to her present time, she's already pregnant with James, right. like kid.
Mm-hmm.
Has her daughter Brianna in like the modern time. So she basically raises Brianna in like the 60s or the 70s. Like, you know, that's kind of when Brianna's being raised through. And Brianna knows, like, you know, that, you know, she knows that Jamie's her real dad and he's in the past. And so when her mom is planning on going back, she gives her a necklace with a precious stone in it. It's for the trip, she says.
Hmm.
So that's a little piece of Outlander lore for you, I guess, that you didn't ask for.
Yeah. I didn't get that far with it. So I don't think I've seen her having had the baby. I don't think I got that far.
Again, I just saw clips. I've seen moments. So I've kind of just managed to deduce.
Yeah.
What happened.
Despite, you know, falling off the show, I quite enjoyed it when I was watching it before I kind of left it.
Mm.
And it's got a high production value. Like they put a lot of effort in, like, the costuming, and you don't at all feel, it doesn't feel hokey. It's not soap opera-y really at first.
Some of the acting can feel a little bit soap opera-y sometimes. Like there was a couple moments where I was just like, oh, really? Okay. Well, that's a choice that we made. And just from like an actor perspective, like, right. No one's ever been in that situation before, so it's like, how do you act in this situation?
Because
people usually pull from, like, you know, real life experiences. But like the parts that I found the most intense were like when, you know, there's the threat of someone being killed, and like how many people realistically have been in that situation that are actors today. I'm sure there are some, unfortunately. I like that's a terrible situation to be in, but like, you're kind of playing off, you know, imagination at that point.
Right.
And oftentimes imagination is being drawn from stuff that you've already seen in other movies.
Yeah.
So
that's true. My number one is Jack Gleason playing Joffrey Baratheon in Game of Thrones. And again, because it's more than just a film, he was in it for several seasons. Everything about him was just spoiled, pure evil, even from the beginning. He goes from mischievous to you want to pitch him off a roof to, well, pardon the pun, you want to, you really despise him because he is directly threatening, you know, some of the characters that you really, adore. He's also a relatable type in the real world, in the spoiled brat that, because of their wealth, can get away with really just about anything. But then you couple that with the violence of Game of Thrones. And again, the violence that you get to see from Joffrey is intimate violence. It's where there's an expectation of no violence. And it just becomes grotesque and just really disturbing. Like, he's not just a villain. He's a disturbed villain. Like, there is something wrong with this boy.
Yeah.
And then the boy thing is, like, his age in the show. The fact that he's sub-teenager and has this level of power, this level of malice, it's just like, wow. Like, I just could not process. It was one of those performances and villains that I just really hated. But the show needed, and it was good that it was there. Like, it's not like it's an excellent performance. It's something I would hate for Game of Thrones to be without, you know, Gleason as Joffrey Baratheon. There were some other villains in Game of Thrones as well, but he was the one that stood out to me as the most kind of like disturbing. I didn't like Stannis Baratheon either. And I mean, as in I found him a decent villain because he was a villain, but he was misguided. Like it was almost religious in that how he was making his decisions.
See,
was
never
blind.
Found...
I guess he wasn't necessarily a villain. He was just a dangerous. I never found him to be evil. No, he was, but he was doing evil things in the name of good. Like it was one of those misguided, miscalculated, misled sort of situations. But because he had that power and people couldn't necessarily question him, it just led to all this. I find the villains that I find the most threatening are the ones where they're usually in a position of power, like Jack Randall, like mm-hmm. Joffrey Baratheon, where you can relate in the real world, yeah. where you've been in a situation where either a boss or, you know, someone that has authority, you know, someone in government is doing this evil, evil stuff, and you can do nothing about it, despite the fact that you've gone through all the right channels. And that's where I find, you know, Joffrey Baratheon and those kind of things really make my skin crawl, because they make you think of real world situations, or actually Frank Underwood as well. They make you think of real world situations where that evil is existing and you can do nothing about it because of just, that's just the way the world works sometimes. And I think that those villains mm-hmm. in films and television is where I really, the hair on the back of my neck stands up and just like, ooh, yeah. If I had Superman powers, yeah, boy, you would be number one on the list, you know, like, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, well, that's me. That's a long version of my five. What are yours?
So I didn't really put mine in any particular order, but I guess I'll name them off in order.
Sure.
So I say, like, my number five is I don't remember the actress who played her, but Ursula in Little Mermaid. We discussed this really briefly in the pre-show, but like,
oh yes,
I wasn't sure if we were going through like actors specifically, like actors who played villains or like villains. So as a character, the villain of Ursula I always found her to be very terrifying. And then this also expands over into video game world as well. I don't know if you've ever played Kingdom Hearts. I don't know if you're familiar with Kingdom Hearts, but Ursula is a villain that you can fight in Kingdom Hearts, and she's the worst goddamn villain in the whole game. I think I ended up stopping. I stopped playing the game and waited 2 months before I approached it again because I was just so frustrated with trying to fight Ursula. It was insane.
Wow.
Pat Carroll. Ursula is like a special place name. Yes. She's done other things though too.
I think she's played other villains. Done? Kingdom Hearts 2, ER. She was in ER. More Kingdom Hearts. She was in Nancy Drew, Bridesmaids, Old Woman in the Car. Doesn't look like she's
Oh,
done.
Yes.
She's done mostly cartoon and voice work. It looks like not a lot of a lot of stuff. But most of her fame, I think, comes from
Ursula.
Ursula, yeah. And really, I mean, she... See if I can get, she was, well, okay. So she was born in 1927. So,
oh, wow.
I would say most of her film work probably came before The Little Mermaid, at which point we don't know. We probably don't know anything. There's a long list here, 70s, 60s. Yeah, she was in a lot of stuff, but nothing that I have seen.
Yeah.
I just love her voice. Like her, it sounds like smoke.
She's
a pack
got a great
day,
voice. Sort of. But it's also like to look at her. I've never seen a photo of her as a person before. To like to hear that voice, like to think of that voice coming out of someone so little.
Exactly, right?
It's kind of amazing.
And she's got
right?
these cute little round grandma glasses. Like, I mean, it would be a really fun
party.
Yeah,
she's adorable.
Imagine the fun party trick if your grandma is Pat Carroll and she can kind of lean over at the dinner table and just like, lend me your voice. And he's like, what? Don't do that. Don't do that, Nana.
Don't do that. Grandma, that's so creepy.
I would imagine some voice actors probably had a lot of fun with that kind of stuff. That would be...
Oh, Mark Hamill for sure.
Yes.
Joker?
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. I'm sure he just pulls out Joker all the time.
Imagine how fun it would be. Like, you know, you're alongside a stoplight with Mark Hamill somewhere in California, and he just decides to, you're like, you can't really tell that it's him, but he kind of like rolls down the window a crack and just starts cackling like the Joker.
Yeah, 100%. Or if I feel like he would do that though too, if someone had like a Batman like decal or like a Joker decal, he'd just be like, you know, he'd probably just yell something at you.
Oh,
Mark Hamill just seems like a really wholesome, down to earth person.
I can hear it now. Like, you've got a Batman's license plate, and he pulls up to you and just starts talking to himself in the car next to him. Batman, why is it always Batman? Everybody loves Batman.
Yeah,
he just kind of goes on this rant.
Yeah. I could totally hear it.
I wish I could do better Joker impressions. I mean,
that was pretty good though. I was going to say that was pretty great.
I can't actually do the voice impression. I could do the cadence a little bit, but I won't do it now because I'm not prepared. But I sent either a clip or a email, voice email, into an old gaming show called The Ladies of Leet. It was my friends Kim and Nicole Spag, and I can't remember the third co-host. But they were just a bunch of lady gamers, and they would talk about video games much like any other podcast that did, but it was from their perspective as grown women gamers. Great show. Mm-hmm. But I sent, it was called The Ladies of Leet. So it kind of had this long kind of like pull off the tongue with hard consonants. So I did my best Heath Ledger Joker impression, something about part of the plan and kind of like gave like a little plug, like, you're listening to The Ladies of Leet, it's all part of the plan, or something like that. And I did it in my best Batman or Chris Nolan Joker kind of impression.
Joker.
And yeah. I think the result was like, that was really creepy, please don't do that again. It was just, yeah, it was just fun to do. And I'm not an actor, so I don't do that kind of thing normally, but yeah, like that voice. See, actors,
I'm an actor and I can't do, oh my God, they mess. I'm an actor, but I can't really do impressions very well. I'm not very good at impressions. Because I find it weird to imitate people personally. Like, like, I don't know. I've never really tried to imitate anybody, but.
Have you seen the clips of Cumberbatch doing celebrity impressions?
Yeah.
He's terrifyingly good.
He's so good. Even Tom Hiddleston, which leads me into my next character.
Nice.
Which is Tom Hiddleston. Well, Loki. I think he's one of my favorite villain actors. He's actually done a lot of really, really great roles in general. I don't think he's ever really done a villainy character. I think Loki is his most villainy character. And I'm still not convinced that Loki's totally a villain, personally. That's just me.
Yeah. I can see that.
But he's done some bad things, you know? He's done some evil stuff. So I'm going to count it. And also, I just love Tom Hiddleston.
And like, this forever. And this is where I'm with you, where it's like, I'm not entirely sure that he's a villain so much as he is like a mischievous foil. Like, he's not necessarily out to...
Mm-hmm.
He's just out for himself. He's not really out to destroy all the things. Whereas Thanos would be more of a villain. And that's hard to measure, yes, too, because like, I really enjoyed that performance, but I wouldn't put what's his name, Josh Brolin, who plays Thanos, like, I wouldn't put that as my top villain performance either. I guess because Thanos is just so one note, but that's what you want in a superhero villain. Like, so they don't necessarily make the best villains, they make the villains we need for those particular films. With Tom Hiddleston, I mean, even I as a dude can say, like, okay, he's a very attractive man, and I do kind of find
he's very attractive.
I find it hard to put villain like on that, you know, in the same way that I have a hard time believing Henry Cavill is a bad guy. Like, I just, there's something charismatic and, you know, Hollywood about these guys where, and I don't mean to knock their acting chops, I just find it hard. I find a lot of the villains with, like, say, Jack Gleason aside, people like Bardem, D'Onofrio, Spacey, they're at a certain age where the villain can kind of just roll right into it. Whereas when you're, you know, young and good looking like Tom Hiddleston and some of these other guys, it's a little bit harder. But again, Jack Gleason, Joffrey, very young dude, and did a bang up job.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Jack Gleason was amazing. But like, I think what I like about villains that are really attractive, like that charisma kind of makes them scarier, because it's sort of like they draw you in to make them think that they're, you know, a friend a little bit, or like, you know, they have like this face of someone trustworthy, but they're really not. And I think that's almost more terrifying than, you know, I'm a monster, I'm about to get you, which kind of, again, so it's with everything to my next villain character, which is, well, the actor is Imelda Staunton, but she plays Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter. She kind of has this persona of like being very, very sweet and wholesome, and she wears a lot of pink, and she likes kittens, and she just drinks tea, and she just looks like a really cute grandma character, but is the worst heinous character I think I've ever experienced in any show. Like, just like, that looks nice. Like, you know, she has, she's the character that has like the pretense of being kind when she's really just sinister in a way that I think is almost more sinister than the actual villain of the whole Harry Potter series, which is Voldemort. But you ask anyone who's ever read Harry Potter before, and then like, it's like, who is the worst character in that whole book? And everyone's like, Dolores Umbridge. With it, like, that's the immediate response that everyone has to that. And every time, like, I forget about her, and everyone's like, Dolores. I'm like, oh, Dolores. I almost get more of like an uncomfortable feeling in my stomach thinking about her than I do Voldemort, because you kind of expect Voldemort to be the villain.
Yeah.
Well, Dolores was just so villainous in a way that was just underhanded and, you know, abusing children specifically, abusing a boy specifically, and not just, you know, the world as a whole. You know what I mean?
And I think too that she's in a position of power. She's operating for the most part within the rules of that universe, whereas Voldemort is outside of the rules, thwarting the rules, against the rules, very visually known bad guy, you know, and everyone, including people in positions of authority, denounce Voldemort for the most part, you know, on the surface. So it's one of those things where like, she has that underlying, like when she, as a, you know, teacher, professor at Hogwarts, tells you to do something, you know, she's got no good intentions, but because she's an instructor, you kind of have to obey, or you're supposed to obey her because that's your, you know, student teacher relationship sort of thing. So she's abusing trust. And I think that that's what really makes her irky. I agree. She reminded me of, I don't want to get into any kind of, there's a topic I'll avoid, but she has the same sort of misguided direction. That's just, she's so sure of herself and everything is, she's just, she's the person that you can't argue with. Do you know what I mean? Like if you try to change, her mind about something, even though if you knew you were right, she would still be, she would have some sort of justification in her own little misguided world that would mean that it's okay to continue doing what she's doing. And that to me is terrifying. Like that's where like she's not doing anything for good, but she has, everything is just so justified. So like she's so sure that what she's doing is
right.
Right. That it's, but yet it's so wrong to anybody that has a moral compass. And you just, you're sitting there in confusion as someone's moral compass could be pointed in so far the wrong direction that it's just, it's almost incomprehensible, you know? I agree. I definitely one of the characters that I find like made my skin crawl when watching the Harry Potter films.
Oh yeah. Terrible. Awful. I hate her so much. and then I guess my last one is like, you know, just again, like not in any particular order, but Jeremy Irons, as a villain character in general, particularly as Scar. I think that's kind of where I think of him the most, but I'm sure there's other things that are just not coming to mind right now, but he's just a very good villain actor anyway. But then, you know, I will also say Christopher Lee and Tim Curry and Alan Rickman, like those guys are also just very good, you know, like villain actors. But it's, you know, Jeremy Irons is up there for sure.
Yeah. I think a lot of what I'm seeing from our conversation about villains, it reminds me of a quote from the Lord of the Rings. I believe it's Frodo. They're talking about Aragorn and whether or not they should trust him. And the line is, I think a servant of the enemy would look fairer and feel fouler. And that to me sounds like Dolores Umbridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I agree. 100%.
So speaking of villains and heroes and all the things that goes along with Titans season 2 was something that Megan has had a chance to consume over the last little while. I saw it back in the beginning of February and I did give a little bit of a review here on the show, but it was spoiler free. It's been out for a while now. I feel like those people that really wanted to watch it have probably already seen it since it's bingeable on Netflix. But I know that you and I had a really long conversation about Titan season one. And so I'm curious to know kind of like how you felt about season two. But we'll leave a big spoiler warning here. So for people that have not seen it or are it's on their list, they haven't gotten to it yet, you might want to check out, because there's no way to talk about this kind of stuff without spoiling character reveals, you know, other things of that kind of nature. So you have been warned. But Megan, what did you think kind of overall from Titan season two?
I don't know. I don't know. I think like the beginning was definitely a lot stronger than the last season, for sure. Definitely a lot stronger. And you know, I was liking a lot of the characters more, and people had just kind of grown into their characters better. Like, you know, I think we said before, like, you know, there was time between the first season and the second season, so actors were able to actually work on their character and had been with them for a long time, and you know, were able to find out who they were a little bit more. But it felt really choppy as a whole. Like, it was just really PC. And I often didn't know where we were, where I would forget where we were. So there's a couple moments with Donna where I was just like, why is she so angry? And then I was like, all right, her boyfriend just died. Okay, that makes sense.
The flashback stuff.
Yeah, the flashbacks. Like, I almost like kind of forgot that those were flashbacks, and then I was like, because the flashbacks are like, they're not all together in like modern time, but you know, enough of them are still kind of together in the same space that when the flashbacks do happen, sometimes you just kind of lose sense, or at least I lost sense. I don't know. And some of the character journeys were just really, really weird. Like, Garth's broke my heart, or not Garth's, Gar broke my heart.
So that points out one of the first things I thought was really dumb, and I don't think it's necessarily the series. I think it might be just something that unfortunately the comics put forward, but Garth and Gar are so close together that I found it difficult. If you couldn't hear the characters properly, you'd be confused as to who they were talking about. And I thought that was
That's why I always watch with subtitles.
Or just don't name your two main characters in the series Gar and Garth. Like, come on. Like, that to me is just, well, it's like, yeah, well, it's like Sauron. Yeah, it's like Sauron and Saruman. Like, it just, that to me drove me nuts the first time I read Lord of the Rings, too.
But yeah.
Anyway, continue.
But yeah, like his, you know, him being operated on at Cadmus and everything was that, like, I feel like Gar has gotten the short end of the stick. And I feel like Beast Boy in general, Beast Boy is a character. I feel like in every single media where Beast Boy is present, he always gets the short end of the stick. In a lot of different ways. Like, he's always played as like, I mean, he's a goofy character, he's a goofy happy-go-lucky character, but he's always kind of passed off as like someone who's replaceable and forgettable, which makes me kind of sad because I really like him as a character. But this one, like, you know, he was, you know, frustrated and angry, and I think he was feeling a little bit weird and guilty because he, you know, got, you know, we kind of just forced Rachel into some of the stuff, and Dick, you know, killed him essentially, and then somehow he was okay. Like, Rachel managed to bring him back, so I think he feels like weirdly indebted to everybody, but also weirdly cautious of everyone. And then he's the only one trying to keep them all together, trying to reestablish the Titans, and then he just ends up, you know, getting fucked over. I'm sorry, I've dropped so many F-bombs in this episode. I have a lot of feelings today.
I agree with your assessment of Gar. I think that the problem is that they don't give him a character arc. They give him a character line, and it's just straight down. It just gets worse and worse and worse. So they're kicking the nicest, best character in the dirt constantly. So you never have a good feeling. You never have a happy ending. And this is where I feel like Titans is gritty for the sake of being gritty. And it's like, yes, you can be gritty, but you have to have some sort of catharsis. Like, you have to have some good feelings communicated to your audience, or they just give up. Because they hate feeling shitty all the time. And it's, I'm trying to struggle with another show that did it, but there was another show that was like that, where I was just like, well, you know, Walking Dead was like that. It's like, I'm just done feeling like garbage the whole time I'm watching this show. Like, I just, you know, everyone's dying all the time. It's terrifying, yes, but like, there's no solace. There's no breath. There's no break. There's no hope. And I didn't find there was a lot of hope in Titans season two, but even less so when you start to look at individual character arcs, because they don't really have arcs, like I said. But yeah, no, that's too bad. How did you feel about Donna Troy?
I think that was the worst decision they could have ever made, honestly. Mm. Because like she was my favorite throughout the entire thing, because she seemed like the most fully fleshed out character. And I think that's a testament to the actress as well. Like, I don't know. I don't remember the name of who played her. But
Connor Leslie, I want to say. I have IMDb open for specifically that reason. Survey says Connor Leslie. I was right. Donna Troy.
Connor Leslie. She's wonderful. Like, she's a really good actor. Mm-hmm. And she was what redeemed the first season for me. If I'm being honest, like, yep. As soon as Donna Troy came in, I was like, great, excellent. We got someone who's actually sane here. So that gutted me. Like, I think it just sort of took all the wind out of my sails. And I was like, well, okay. Yeah, sure. I guess, like, I don't know. I like her too.
I like her too as a tough, like very attractive, but leather jacket wearing kick your butt character. Like, she's a
but also strong. Not like an asshole though, like,
no, exactly, she has a place tender of moments. Love,
yeah, like, she is, like, that's the thing that I really like, especially the acting. I don't know if it was like just really good writing for Donna or if the actor just took it and ran with it in stride and made, you know, she kind of reminds me of like a female Tom Hiddleston a little bit, because like Tom was given, oh, you're a villain character, okay, and then Tom took that and made like fleshed out his character so much on his own time.
Yeah.
And the way he performed it, there was so much nuance. Despite the fact that he was a villain, there was a lot of other nuance. I feel like Connor also did that with Donna. And like, you know, despite Donna not having a lot of, you know, her dialogue was fairly simple. There wasn't a lot, you know, in it, but she had really, really clear emotion every single time. Like, she's a very skilled actor. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if maybe the death was written in because she's leaving the show, or
that's
if it was just the way, yeah, if it's, the way that, you know, because the comics don't go that way. Like, Donna Troy goes on to do other things later. Like, mm-hmm. There's a second Wonder Girl that comes in, but Donna Troy becomes somebody else. Troya and Darkstar are, you know, like two of the different aliases that she adopts after like leaving the Wonder Girl mantle. Troya and Darkstar are, you know, two other aliases that she takes on. I think Darkstar is most notable.
Also just a better name.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, when, you know, you're, you know, the sidekick of, you know, prominent person, you know, it's that's sort of what's expected. But like, when she kind of comes into her own and is like, you know, okay, I'm not just Wonder Girl. I have my own identity now. Mm-hmm. You know, so I've always really liked Donna Troy, and I, you know, I was so excited that she was involved, because I don't think she's been involved in anything before. And you know, it was, I think, a disservice to the whole show to have her gone.
Yeah. And so, I chalked it up to, you know, the death of Donna Troy at the very end, as in like, you almost had a decent landing and then you messed it up, and it felt just like killing Superman in Batman v Superman. It just feels bad. I don't care if it happened in the comics. I don't care if you've got, you know, some other weird reason. If you're not going to explain that reason this season, then it just mm-hmm. ends your season feeling terrible and really does not make me want to go back. Now, no. I'll stick with my previous comment from a few weeks ago of saying, like, I still think that season two was better than season one.
Yeah, I agree.
Acting and writing was better. I'm not saying it was the best, but it certainly was much better than season one. They certainly have a better idea of what they want the show to be.
Yeah. And they had a bigger budget too. You could tell with like wigs and costumes and things like that. The wigs were so much better. Still not great, but way better.
Still not great. I think one of the things I do like so much about Donna Troy, and why I think she makes that tough character but still has that caring aspect to her, is that she is at her most violent when she's defending friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're mm-hmm. coming at her, she's gonna like stop you, but if you're coming after one of her friends, she's gonna end you. Like, it's just it's one of those things where she's very defensive, and it comes across even in conversation when she's talking with Dick. Like, she's having a falling out with Dick Grayson, but she still wants him to be safe and alive and well, you know. Like, she's advocating for his much of his mental health as she is for his physical well-being, but at the same time, still able to say, like, you are making some dumbass decisions right now, and mm-hmm. I can't believe that you're doing this.
She's really sisterly. Like, yes. That's kind of, yeah. Also, I also got to say, I really like how, like, there was never any suggestion of romantic tension between Donna and Dick. I really, really like that. I feel like that's never done in anything ever. Mm-hmm. If you have a guy and a girl, they grow up together. Undoubtedly, at some point, there's going to be feelings. I just really appreciate that that was never even a concept.
Yeah, the Dawson's Creek effect was not apparent, thankfully.
No, which, thank God, because Jesus Christ. I feel like that happens every single time, like, yeah. With anything. To the point that, like, I'm actually writing a short film script that's about, like, just because dude and girl are friends, does that mean they're dating? Like, when, yeah. Does that not mean they want to date each other? Yeah. Like, that's not always a thing. So I liked they had more of, like, a sibling sort of, you know, they were friends, they were close, but you know they're obviously both very attractive people, but they care about each other in such a genuine fashion, in the fact that they weren't raised together from infancy, like, but they just kind of, you know, fell into that sort of, you know, routine
sidekick friends.
And you know, I'm really sad that just it, like, hit me in a bad way.
And also
feels
dumb.
Bad, man.
Like, she dies in a way that, yeah. You don't think would kill her. It's like, she's a superhero. That's, she's got superpowers. How does just, like, electrocuting people, how does that not just not phase her? You know, like, it's she can lift stuff and throw buses. Just like, how does this kill her? And that's why I think that we don't know some behind the scenes where she's like, I'm done with this series, or I have a better opportunity somewhere else as an actor and I have to move on. And I just don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't looked it up, but I don't know whether the Titans is getting a season 3. But
it is.
Is it? So yeah, I agree with you.
Talk about it, but I do know for sure there's a season 3.
Yeah. So one of the best things about your show is killed in the last seconds of the season, you're just kind of like, well, that was one of the reasons I was thinking about coming back next season. You've just removed that. The other thing about Donna Troy is her story arc, or at least the story reveal they did this season that I thought was dumb, is there's an awful lot of places in Titans season 2 where the good guys are alive specifically because the script says so. And like, Deathstroke had her dead to rights, could have chopped her head off. She was done. And he just walked away purely for the reason so he could say the line, stay away from my kid. That's the only reason. It's like, if you wanted to stay, you know how Deathstroke...
Oh, is that when she went to the museum?
Yeah, she went to the museum.
And like,
He destroyed her. And one, it felt weird. Yeah. It felt weird that he could even do that. But then secondly, like, it was no contest. It's not like she stood a chance. It was really strange. And it's one of those things where you're like, if you know what the best way, murderous Deathstroke, is to keep people away from your kids? Is to kill them. If you kill them, they are permanently staying away from your kid. Like, it made no sense. And I find that happened a lot in this series with Deathstroke, and how they make some sort of excuse that he wants to see them suffer. And it's like, no, he's not that villain. Like, that to me doesn't really make any sense. All that said, I did really enjoy S.A. Morales as Deathstroke. I thought he was a little old. But I also did find him quite menacing, the calmness and the confidence that he brought. I thought he looked good in terms of, like, he looked believable. He looked to me like someone that could fight and win and do all those kind of things. So I enjoyed his presence as the bad guy. I thought his kids were weird. I didn't necessarily know that from the comics, nor did I expect it. Especially Jericho. I thought Jericho was just dumb. I didn't like that whole arc.
I mean... Jericho is he's not a well-known part of the comics, but he's a part of the comics, like, right. Like I'm as soon as I heard the name Jericho, I was like, oh, okay, that's where we're going with this. And you know, Rose Wilson as well, like they're not,
she was okay,
they're older, older series of comics.
And I found that Rose Wilson was also one note for so long in the show. Like, it's just like every time she opened up her mouth, it's like, okay, insert grumpy line here. Like, I also
found that with Jason too.
Oh gosh, I wanted to throw Jason Todd off a bus. I thought it was terrible.
Yeah, which sucks, because I like whenever I hear about Jason Todd, I was just like, okay. Like, you know, Jason, I don't, like, do you know what happens to Jason in the end? Like, do you know Jason's story?
Jason Todd was the one killed by the Joker, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, there was a moment where I was watching, I'm like, are they gonna, are, like, when he was hanging off the building, I'm like, are they gonna kill Jason Todd like this? Like, are we, that's not how this goes. Like, if we're going from, they're obviously doing their own story, but like, wow, that's a really, like, blatant disregard for comic book canon. Lore as a whole. Like, yeah, that is, like, that is a canon thing. And, like, canon can change, but that's, like, the only thing in canon that is, like, solidified in every single rendition of Batman.
Because it's such a hinge for Batman, right? Like, it's such a character point for Bruce Wayne, because the killing joke, is that the comic? The killing joke, I think, is the comic. That
Yeah.
Like, and that kind of stuff, it's like, I understand that the show is going to take some leeway. But I just, again, found, I am at my wit's end with one note characters in media. Like, I'm done. So one of the reasons why I haven't returned to it, but one of the reasons why I liked, The Expanse so much, and, Seamus in The Expanse has that capacity to be a one note character, but then they start to take him in different directions. And like halfway through every season, they give you some sort of twist with him. And you're just like, oh wow. Okay. That's deeper than I expected. Cause he's kind of like the muscle grunt, you know, like you, so you kind of expect him to just be like the brute force. And they give him a lot more nuance than that. Whereas, much like Brock had said about, I can't remember the name of the actor of the character, but he's essentially the same dude in everything he plays, and he's the same character throughout The Expanse while it lasts. And he plays the detective, and him again, every time he opened his mouth, he had nothing to contribute emotionally, plot wise. It was just like, he's just on this, he's a one note character, and I have no time for it. I find it condescending writing. But I found that in some ways Titan season 2 started to get a little bit more well-rounded. I really liked Rachel. I was disappointed she didn't get to do very much. And honestly, I'm kind of, the Titans season 2, the Titans were kind of grounded. You didn't really get to see much from the actual Titans. You just got to see flashbacks of the old Titans, where all the action really took place. But I really liked the emotional stuff they were putting Rachel through. I thought the way that she was portraying it, handling it, was interesting. I thought the visuals were really cool. You get the sense that she's super powerful. The problem that I find is that I feel like we've got season 1 and season 2 of Titans that could have easily been condensed into one season and the chaff chopped off and given us some really interesting arcs. Like, if you think about Rachel's arc from season 1 to season 2, it makes a much better story than the two arcs separated.
Yes, I agree.
You know, like, and I feel like they, especially like even with the way that they start the series, like they start the series with Rachel defeating this demon dad that she has, who is like portrayed as like a Thanos level bad guy. And she basically flicks him off the face of the planet and then does nothing for the rest of the season. It's like,
I know.
So you're telling me you have a nuclear bomb and you just don't use it when bad guys strike? Like, she could own Slade Wilson with a pinky and yet nothing happens. And so that kind of stuff I found very constipated in terms of the storytelling.
Yeah, like there was like continuity errors within its own story. Mm-hmm. Like it just, you know. Yeah, that's it. That's all I can really
say. That's what I mean. Like the whole feeling is just like when you want to talk about it, you just kind of go, like, I don't know how to say it.
I
was disappointed with how Wilson died. I really thought that because of the rivalry, I feel like there should have been a defeat, and it should have been Nightwing that beat him, not Rose Wilson, or Rose Wilson with her brother inside her head, because that's weird.
I don't dislike that. I know that Rose and Slade had kind of like their own issues anyway. Like, you know, she's always had like a weird thing about her dad anyway, so I think it's kind of like a bit of a retribution for her. But also I do think that maybe they should have done it together.
Something weird
was about it.
Well, her killing her father undermines Dick Grayson as any kind of power and authority. He doesn't beat him, she does. And so it's like, well, you're supposed to be this badass leader and you don't, like, she's more badass. Like, I understand that we're kind of splitting hairs, but it feels like it undercuts his, they take so bloody long to get Dick Grayson into Nightwing and put him through this weird prison thing that was not well thought out and really dumb and really long-winded. Like, it was something that was one half of an episode stretched out into three. And I feel like
the only reason they did it was that, like, you could have that conversation with the guy in the prison cell and being like, oh, this guy, this person, do you know this person? He's going to come and he's going to save us all.
Oh, the spirit of the
bird. Some spirit or something, yeah. I mean, like, I feel like that's the only reason, because I'm like, oh, Nightwing. Okay, that's what we're going with this. And obviously, like, if once Dick Grayson stops being Robin, he becomes Nightwing, if you know anything about the comic books. But
yeah,
I feel like that was the only reason for it. And then it just went, it kept going. And I was like, okay.
And you could sum that whole thing up into like an off-color comment from Bruce Wayne about some sort of bird of prey, right? And have, and just hang on Dick Grayson for a beat and have him kind of go, huh. And then just like leave that as the little story beat, the little Easter egg for the fans. And then later on, he becomes, you know, Nightwing. Again, Nightwing, happy with where Dick Grayson landed. He should have landed there in the seventh episode, not in the last one. I would have preferred to see a lot more than one fight. I thought he looked great. I thought the costume, you know, as far as like stuff like that, the costume looked good. I still think Dove and Hawk looked stupid, but. Nightwing, I thought he looked good, and he's like, he's tall. He's got he's got that physique. Like he in the ring, like in the sparring ring with Rose Wilson earlier on in the series, he obviously holds his own. And there's where they do a little nod where she breaks his quarterstaff. And then, so he's got these two sticks, the two batons, which is what Nightwing is kind of famous for using, in the comics.
Yeah.
And so he takes that stance and he's like, oh yeah, comic book pose. Here we go. Like that kind of stuff. Season two is not without its merits. It's not without its good beats. I really enjoyed Superboy. It didn't at all fit the season. It was this strange left field. We lost all context with everybody else, and we just followed Superboy for an episode to bring him up to basically save Jason Todd when he fell, when Slade Wilson killed him. Another thing that was dumb about Slade, you know, the Slade Wilson fight was like, at any point you could have killed this kid, just killed him. But you obviously, because the Joker kills Jason Todd, you can't. Like, just, I mean, because the script says so, it just created this unfortunate sequence of events. But the episode and episodes after introducing Connor as Superboy, I really liked them. I found myself smiling. I found myself engaged. They didn't waste any time. He has superpowers. He's, you know, a two-day-old clone, but he's not an infant. Like, he's just, he's clueless emotionally, or confused emotionally, and then clueless as far as social norms. But other than that, they don't really lean too heavily on the fish out of water, because they kind of chalk it up to his alien DNA. Because the way that they outline it in the show is that he's a clone of Lex Luthor and Clark Kent, so Superman. And so he's got the emotional short fuse from Lex Luthor and the intelligence of Lex Luthor. But then he also has like the compensating skills and all of the strength and a lot of the attributes of Superman. So like, you sit him down in front of a puzzle, and once you kind of tell him, oh, it's a puzzle, this is how it works, he solves it in no time. But he doesn't realize it's a puzzle at first. So there's like these little humps, but once he's over the hump, he's like, I get it now. And he's like, oh, I only punch the bad people. Got it. And then he's really good at punching the bad people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I found he brought what Gar lost to the series. Like, Gar lost his sense of innocence. He lost his sense of fun.
He did.
And then he found it again with Connor, in that they have this moment where they're just dorking out over like cereal. And Connor has got like a mixing bowl of cereal. And it's so big. I almost cut the clip out and sent it to my mom, because I had one like that. I used to vacation with friends and family on PEI, and I ate a ton when I was a kid. And so I had what was called the Joel Bowl at one of my mom's family friends. And it was essentially
not called the Joel Bowl.
It was. That's what this lady called it. Her name was Artith. That's what Artis called it. But because it was, I got up early before everybody else, and they just said, look, Joel, like, don't wake us up. Just get yourself some breakfast. And I had a bowl of cereal. But all of the bowls in the house were like these little, like, teacup type things, like little, like, custard dishes. So the bowl that I grabbed out of the fridge, out of the cupboard, was essentially a small mixing bowl. I filled it with cereal, poured some milk on it, and had breakfast. And so forever, it was just labeled, it kept in its own spot. It was the Joel bowl. That's the bowl of cereal that I used to do. That's the best. Right?
I'm broken.
So we've broke Megan. We forgot to inform you that this is the end of this little cafe this week. No. That's too funny. So I know that you and Bethley are big fans of Dick Grayson and Nightwing. How did you feel about the Nightwing reveal and Dick Grayson's arc for the season?
I mean, I liked it. I liked the costume. I liked the costume a lot. I think the costume looks really, really great. I'm trying to remember. Like, I watched it only a couple days ago, and I'm just trying to remember exactly what happened. I mean, it felt like a superhero moment.
Oh, yeah, totally.
For sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Like, I don't know. I think I went in with no expectations, and I kind of left feeling like I didn't have a lot of an opinion. I think that's just been like my whole experience with Titans so far. I just went in with no expectation, been like, okay, that's what's happening. But I really like the costume, and I like that they actually did do the Nightwing thing. Because I feel like it's always been teased, or like it's been adjacent to Nightwing, but having actual Nightwing, and you know, the guy, what's his name, who plays Dick Grayson?
Brenton Thwaites.
Yeah, he's very good.
Oh, very, he's a fantastic actor.
He's a really good actor.
He some odd script choices and some odd writing this season, but like,
yeah,
you believe, not only do you believe him when he's being like an emotional scene, whether he's conflicted, angry, sad, whatever he's doing, it is, you never question it. But then on top of that, you also 100% believe that he can kick your ass.
Yeah. Oh no. 100%. Yeah. He's also built as fuck.
Yeah. He's an athlete. He's an athlete. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. No. Like I like that. I think the journey to get there was kind of stupid, but I like that we got there.
That's where I landed too. Like, I like where we landed, but how we got there was really weird.
Like everyone's just like, it's not about the destination, it's the journey. And it's just like, well, thank God that journey's over. Jesus Christ. That's kind of what it feels like. Like the destination is what we were aiming for. It's like, can we just get there already, please? Like, yeah. this journey is dumb. But no, I like that we've got to that point. Yeah, I think one of the things that I had a big problem with this season, though, weirdly, and I'm really disappointed because I really like her, is Corey, Starfire.
Oh, yeah.
Starfire's whole thing.
Forgettable.
Forgettable. Like, she just, I mean, obviously she was going through a lot, but like the drinking and like, I don't know, like she just really, really went off the rails. Have they ever, I don't remember, did they ever use the name Starfire for her? Because they're referring to her sister as Blackfire.
They did right from the beginning. Season one at some point.
They refer to as Starfire?
Either they refer to her as Starfire or they refer to her power as Starfire. And
so okay.
And then someone like Gar, I think Gar kind of says like, "Ooh, that's a cool nickname," or something. There's some sort of like fan nod to that effect. But because they want this to be quote unquote real, they always refer to each other as their first names, not their aliases. Like they don't call Gar Beast Boy. You know what I mean? So they kind of go down the first name basis sort of line. They don't call Dawn Dove, you know what I mean? Like they just, that kind of,
yeah.
They go the other way, which is fine. It just means that it's just kind of hard to know whether they're really kind of rolling into those personas. And I found Corey's story to be same old, same old. You know, like someone's troubled and dealing with stuff and someone's avoiding things. So what's the best way to do that? Let's just party and drink ourselves into oblivion. We've never seen that before. I don't know, maybe in the 90s with 90210 it started and it has never stopped since in media. Yeah. Like it's just this constant trope of like, you know, let's make this look, you know, terrible. It's like, no, to me it's not interesting. It's like I'm watching a show about people with superpowers in many cases, or at least assassin skills beyond anyone, you know, humanly possible. That's why they're comic books. That's why it's fantasy. And I don't want to see the real life underbelly of this fantasy. It's just not interesting to me, you know, and it undermines everybody as heroes. Like they skirt the line with Grayson. They keep him pretty. He lands on the white side, you know, in the end, and they doesn't really go into the black. He gets a little gray from time to time. But he gets gray with bad people. Like when he breaks arms and beats people up, they're evil SOBs that he's kicking butt. So you don't really mind, you know. Whereas other people, it tends to be more complicated. And I find that Starfire or Corey's disregard for other people outside, like she always returns for Rachel. She wants to be with her friends, but her disregard for everyone else just feels really.
But it's also really unlike the character too. Like the character in the comic books is not, she's not that gritty. My first ever interaction with Starfire ever was from the Teen Titans original, like animated series.
Oh, okay.
Where she was, you know, like kind of, you know, fresh off the boat, like not really sure of the customs and everything. And, you know, she was fierce and she was powerful, but like she was also still really innocent and like wanted to learn about stuff and like, you know, liked cute things and, you know, things like that. So, I mean, I like that they've gone in a little bit of a different direction with this, but also just the complete, like, I'm going to screw you up, I'm going to kill you sort of mentality that Corey has going on. Like, I think to this day, I think one of my favorite lines of season one was when she was just like, oh shit, Dick's going to think I did it. Like when the family dies. You know, I thought that was kind of funny because at this point, like she's been, you know, she has amnesia. She's kind of just operating off of this pure base instinct of like survival and kind of just needing to be tough because she just, that's all she really knows at that point.
Yeah.
But when she finds who she is again, she just seems a little bit more, she's passive and she's more pulled back, but just also just seems like a wildfire in a way that I don't think I've never thought of.
And doesn't seem to learn from Starfire.
Yeah. No. And that's kind of the weird thing. And, I also find it really weird that, like, just the naming conventions, I find it weird that she's not going by Starfire, but her sister is going by Blackfire. I find that really weird because Blackfire's real name is Commander. Comey is what they would call her. Because Starfire's full name is Coriander.
Right.
So Blackfire has, like, you know, her own real name. But Commander sounds like a weird name anyway. So, so I can see why they're using Blackfire, but it's weird that they haven't she hasn't said, I'm Starfire. That's my name. To me, it just feels kind of, I don't know. I'm bouncing around between thoughts here. It feels like they had so many ideas for all the different characters, but couldn't fit all of the story points for every character in this season. So it just felt like there was a whole lot of not a lot going on. Like there's stuff happened, but I feel like they were putting their attention onto weird moments that didn't quite need to be focused on.
Yeah.
In my opinion, like there was a lot of stuff that was just like, okay, why are we taking away time to focus on this right now? Like what?
Yeah. I felt that way about a lot of the interaction between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson.
Yeah, you know? That was weird. I mean, like, I know you're not really a huge fan of the casting choice. I don't dislike it, but yeah, like a lot of the time I was just like, what is this? Why are we doing this? Like,
yeah,
and it's weird.
Ian Glenn is a good actor. I really liked him in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So it's not that I don't like Ian Glenn. It's that as Bruce Wayne, he doesn't really fit the type. Even as, like, he fits the type of like Bruce Wayne from Batman Beyond. Like retired Bruce Wayne, you know, he doesn't, you don't look at him and think like he's going to be able to kick people's butt. It feels very weird in terms of his age and how they portray him. And you don't ever see him as Batman. It's always just a Bruce Wayne conversation. The one time they got it right was when Bruce Wayne gathers all of the other people, all the other members of the team at this little diner in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of shows up. That felt Bruce Wayne-y. Like that felt, he was so casual about it. He had some authority there. They were all in awe. They weren't looking at him the way that Dick looks at him in terms of like, oh gosh, he's doing that thing again. You know, like they're all just kind of like, holy shit, it's Bruce Wayne. You know, like it's Yeah, they were like, did he just really get all of us to go to this? Did he manipulate all of us to? He did. He made. Yeah. He didn't call us and tell us to come here. He just like dropped these little seeds and like led us here like sheep,
yeah.
You know, which is very, very Batman. You know, like that kind of thing makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
What I did find from especially the situations where Dick is seeing Bruce Wayne as a mental projection, like he's having a daydream and basically having father issues and talking with Bruce Wayne in that way. I think they portrayed Bruce Wayne as a dick in ways that they didn't have to.
I agree.
And they could have played it cleaner. They could have played him more like Diner Bruce Wayne the whole show. I don't mind that he's a dick when Grayson is seeing him, because instead of, pardon the double use of the word, but instead of Dick Bruce Wayne, you're seeing Dick's Bruce Wayne. You're seeing Grayson's version. You're seeing how it affected him. So he has this, it's like when you're mad at your parents and you have a certain vision of them and you want to argue with them in your head, but you can't because you know you're probably wrong. So like when you're younger. And so like that, I didn't mind the deviation in like, he's not acting very much like Bruce Wayne, because I knew that it was a projection from Dick Grayson, and Grayson had like a fever and like, there's all these different things going on.
Yeah.
I liked that part. But other than that, I thought that it was just a weird choice and didn't really serve the show. Like they could have done that one cameo in the diner and I would have been fine. That would have been enough for me, you know, or maybe one other cameo with Dick to kind of establish that that's Bruce Wayne. But other than that, I didn't need all the constant, basically side comments that he would make over Dick's shoulder in his head. Like it's, I find it kind of condescending.
Yeah, it felt really out of place.
Yeah.
I mean, you could tell it's like, it's, you know, the voice in Dick's head, but it didn't feel like Bruce. Like it felt like, obviously it was like Dick's perception of Bruce, but it was just a consistent span of like, what is going on with this? What do you stop?
Yeah.
Like there was just something about it that just felt really, really out of place.
Yeah. And, like it felt like some aggression and some feeling of not belonging in Dick's head, but personifying it as Bruce Wayne felt out of place. But that's the point where Dick's going to get the wisdom. He's not going to get it from a character that would be better suited for that voice would be maybe Dick starts to see Jason Todd. Which would be annoying as all hell. Like, I'm glad they didn't do that. But that character personality would better fit the lines being delivered compared to you know, Bruce Wayne. But it has to be some sort of figure of authority. I don't know. It's a little bit strange. I almost kind of wish that, like, they could have twisted it. Like, if you're going to kill Donna Troy, if Donna Troy was the North Star that Dick was seeing in his head, trying to figure out who he was after her death. Like if that loss stuck with him and he was seeing her and she in his head was pointing him in the right direction of Nightwing, then that to me would be a stronger way to do it. Cause she has the attitude. She could make those kind of snide comments and have it be kind of funny and like, you know, aggressive, but with his best interests involved and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, we should probably wrap things up. I do have an internet minute to share with everybody. And the internet minute, in case you're wondering, is of course brought to you by you. The Sizzle Cafe is 100% listener supported. If you're getting value out of the show, please consider putting a little bit of value back into it. You can become a member at patreon.com/thesizzlecafe. Joining at any level gets you an invite to the member only Discord, where we do cool things like the Town Hall Hangout, which was this weekend where we talked with patrons about where the show is going and what to expect in the future, goals we want to set, all that kind of stuff, including feedback for like things you like and things you don't like about the show. You can always voice them in the Discord. So that's patreon.com/thesizzlecafe. Currently at 20 patrons rolling into March. We'd love to make that 21 before April. So if you are thinking about it, if you're on the fence, check it out, patreon.com/thesizzlecafe, and let me know what you think. I have two fantastic Lego picks to share. It was impossible to choose between the two, so I have to choose them both. The Mandalorian Lego sets have hit the interwebs. We've got Lego The Mandalorian and the Child, set 75317. They're blockheads. They're like the little they look like Funko Pops, but they're like Lego blockheads, shelf porn, I call it. Then the Lego Razor Crest, which I didn't realize was the name of the Mandalorian ship from the series, and that's set 75292. So I've got pictures of them in the show notes. We'll have links for everything, of course. The Lego Mandalorian and the Child, this is bananas. This is two blockheads, not one. They're one set, It's only $19.99. That's bananas.
That's bananas for Lego.
For Lego, that's really cheap. Normally, blockheads are around. I bought my niece the Belle from Beauty and the Beast blockheads, and it was like $15, which is perfectly reasonable because it's still a really cool little build and something that you get to have on yourself. And you have a little Lego Belle when you're seven. That's awesome. But like, that's still a reasonable price. So to get two builds, the Mandalorian and the Child, the Baby Yoda, both of them measure 3 inches tall. It's 295 pieces. So for $20, that's ridiculous. I tend to measure Lego in a price per piece ratio, which sounds odd, but it basically measures it out to how much you're paying for the pieces and how long it's going to take you to put together. 300 pieces mm-hmm. is not going to be a big build. You're maybe looking at maybe 90 minutes, but it's 8 cents a piece. Yeah. Normally, Lego retails for 15 to 20. Now, this is after I've put Canadian taxes and stuff on this. So it's kind of like out-of-pocket cash versus price per piece. So even after taxes, at $23, you're looking at about 8 cents a piece.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's so good, though.
Oh, yeah. And it looks fantastic. You've got the hover pram. It has Baby Yoda in it, which is a cool idea. And the pieces underneath the hover pram are the clear, transparent Lego. So it in the right light, it would look like it was floating. I would imagine some people are going to augment this with maybe magnets and have it actually float. Like you could do a mock mm-hmm. of this and have it look really cool. We have the Mandalorian has got like his blaster and his rifle on his back. He's got some custom pieces for his helmet. He looks really cool. They got a lot of detail in these. I think they look fantastic. The Lego Razor Crest, on the other hand, is $129. Ouch. Well, I say ouch. It's not a surprise. It's actually about on par. It doesn't look like much. This is where there's only one photo of this. There's many photos of the Mandalorian and the Child, but there's only the one photo of the Razor Crest. And you really have to look at the dimensions. It's 15 inches by 11 inches by 5.5 inches. So it's a long, flat build, not a very tall build. So when it's next to minifigures, you're like, that doesn't look that big. But it's actually, it's more than a foot long. That's a decent size Lego spaceship. It's about the same size as the Shuttle Tidarium that I have. And the Shuttle Tidarium was like 990 pieces. And this is 1,023. And really there's not a lot of little pieces in the knickknacks. Like there's the minifigs that come with, there's like a Baby Yoda, the Mandalorian, the boss guy, the bounty hunter guy, and then the bounty hunter robot. And so there's not a lot of minifigures that come with it. So most of the pieces are really in the ship. The difference is that the ship just doesn't look all that complicated. And I think it's probably just a bad photo angle. I think they really need to show it more from the front because it's nearly as wide as it is long. Like it's 11 inches wide. So those two fuselage pieces that are the engines, they're quite far apart. So like this is not something that's going to fit in a tiny bookshelf. Like you're going to need like a top shelf kind of for this thing. It's not the most exciting build. So I'm a little bit surprised at the price. It's just a lot of gray. And part of that could be the fact that it's just a lot of gray in the show. So perhaps they could have done a better design on the ship in general, not just Lego, but like maybe, the Mandalorian, the show could have done a better job in making the Mandalorian, the Razor Crest more distinct. I would have loved to have some sort of splash of color on the hull, like a red piece or something like that. Take, for example, Slave One, a Boba Fett ship. It's gray, but it also has a very heavy green note to it, as well as some rust to it. Very distinct shape, very distinct colors. This has got a distinct shape, but it's pretty unremarkable. I get that fits the character, but that doesn't necessarily mean it makes for a fun design. It again looks cool out of my price range, but it would be one of the more iconic ships, I think, from Star Wars in the last decade in terms of Lego and what I would like to have on my shelf. This would be up there in terms of TIE Fighter, X-Wing, Razor Crest, shuttles. I think that the ship is recognizable, I think, now as an iconic ship. It's a little bit low on the interesting side. And again, because there's no details, often these are Lego play sets, right? So this would have some sort of function. You can probably go in the back of it. There's probably a cargo hold. There's probably like a little Baby Yoda bedroom like they had in the show. I've feel like they need to show that kind of stuff for this to really have a value add to it. Because things like the shuttle Tidarium, like the wings go up and down, you can open up the cockpit, there's Chewie and Han are inside. So I need to know more about this before I get too excited about it. But the shape of it looks pretty cool. And it is just exciting to have new Star Wars Lego, and The Mandalorian is such a fun show that I thought these were worth mentioning. But honestly, the Lego Mandalorian and the child take the cake. Like, that just, you win. You win the internet this week.
That's so great. I love the child. He's so cute.
So, so good. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Citadel Cafe. Once again, we hit 90 minutes. Hope you enjoyed. You can find more info about the show and links to some of the things that Megan and I talked about at thecitadelcafe.com. Music for the show was composed by Kevin McLeod, as it always is. You can email us with your ideas and thoughts and feelings at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. You can also find us on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, and Spotify. Soon to be YouTube. I am at episode 340 of uploading the archive from 300 to 350, so expect a link to the YouTube channel soon. Word of mouth is, of course, the easiest way to support the show. Poke a friend in the arm and say, hey, you should listen to this because we were just talking about some nerdy thing that I think you would enjoy. You'd be surprised just how far a personal recommendation goes. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online at joelduggan.com. If you're interested in hiring me as an illustrator, then just drop me a line there. You can check out my other podcast, all about Minecraft, at thespawnchunks.com, and follow me, of course, on social media with just my name, Joel Duggan, very easy to find. Come over and hang out at twitch.tv/Joel Duggan. Lots of really cool, fun content over there. Having a blast with some really kind and fun people in the chat. I think you will too. Megan, where can people find you and all of the cool stuff that you are doing online?
People can find me online on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitch at omegantownsend. And if you want to follow my personal project, The Heir of Keldinen, that is also on Instagram too.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.